Welcome to AUSA's Army Matters Podcast. This is Thought Leaders with Joe Craig. Our guest today is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Cahill, who will talk to us about humanitarian assistance and the future of war. Also joining us is a special guest host, Ellen Toner, who will lead the discussion. Ellen Toner joined the AUSA team as a writer and editor in 2012. She has a degree in literature from the University of Dallas and studied editing at the Denver Publishing Institute. As the editorial manager for AUSA's education and programs, and a proud sister to three brothers in uniform, Toner loves working behind the scenes to support America's military. Ellen, welcome to the podcast. The floor is yours.
Joe, thank you for that introduction. I'm really glad to be on your show today, and thank you so much for having me. Now, as Joe said, our guest of honor today is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Cahill, U.S. Army. He was commissioned through the University of Minnesota's ROTC program in 1999. He served as an aviator with the 3rd Infantry and 1st Cavalry Division, and as a strategist at Headquarters, Department of the Army, U.S. European Command, Department of State, and U.S. Forces Korea. He is currently a PhD candidate at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government, and he holds an MA in International Public Policy from the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. His research interests include military innovation, strategic planning, and organization theory. Jim, welcome to the show, and thank you for being with us today.
It's great to be with you, Ellen.
So, clearly, you have expertise in many fields, but as Joe said, we're here today to talk specifically about humanitarian assistance and future war. I've been studying some of your work on the topic, and I'd like to get the ball rolling with a pretty big question that I hope can provide a good discussion framework for all of our listeners. So when you're looking at humanitarian assistance in future war, I'm wondering if you could just sort of generally identify for us basic, essential, underlying issues that you think will face these humanitarian efforts, and how do you see them playing out?
First of all, I'd just like to say that my practical exposure to humanitarian affairs came in my last assignment. I had the opportunity to serve the State Department as a military advisor and had a backstage pass to see up front this world of international humanitarian system that we've built as an international community since the Second World War, and then increasingly built it up into what I think is a really, really important structural element of our strategic environment. I had that opportunity to see that up front. And now that I'm back in the Army and very much seeing that the advanced thinking that we have been doing regarding strategic competition and potentially future interstate war, my argument is that we're lacking a piece to that conversation. The implications are not only the humanitarian impact of a war on that scale, but the response of these highly capable organizations and how that's going to impact our ability to accomplish our military objectives first and certainly our strategic objectives. I think that we just need to think more deeply about that, and that's what has been my reaction now that I'm back to the Army strategic field.
I just wanted to summarize what you're saying in your last response. As you're back on the military side of things after having been on the front row with the humanitarian side of things, the biggest issue that you're identifying is that leadership perhaps doesn't understand not just the scope of the humanitarian issues facing them, but maybe also what the organizations are capable of that are dealing with those affairs. Is that what you're saying?
We do have some pretty good awareness. We have some places, particularly in AFRICOM and other places in Indo-Pacific Command. There's the Center for Excellence for Disaster Management and Humanitarian Affairs. But what we're devoting our attention to is humanitarian relief in the context of COIN, in the context of post-conflict operations. And what we're missing is an appreciation of the humanitarian needs that are going to be critically important in the context of future interstate war with Russia, China, with Korea. There's no secret about what the impact would be on civilians in a Korean Peninsula conflict.
Sure, that certainly makes sense. So if we're missing these things about humanitarian assistance in future war, what then would you say are 3 or 4 things that we should all know about these affairs if we really want to understand and be ready for the big picture?
Well, I'd say the first thing, and this is what was the thing that kind of surprised me when I got to State Department and had the opportunity to see all this is just the scope and the capabilities that reside in this international humanitarian system. The global networks of multilateral logistical and professional capabilities I was blown away by, and they're operating globally and switching people around in the areas of need. So what's important for us to be aware of as practitioners that are contemplating this future environment is not only in a coin environment, but in other environments, these organizations, they're going to be present, they're going to be players. And I would even say that there's things that we could do with them that would be strategically valuable in terms of getting to the sustainable outcomes that we want to achieve and that they want to achieve. That's the first thing, is just being aware of that expeditionary capability, which I don't think that we have that awareness. Another thing that we should be aware of is, you know, within DOD, we talk a lot about civil-military coordination. And that phrase, civil-military coordination, it does too much work and it means different things to different people. Therefore, the dialogue suffers either at the tactical or the institutional level. And we need to be very specific about what it is that we're talking about when we say coordination. And most of the time, from my perspective, the attention that gets played when you say civil-military coordination has to do with a natural disaster context. These are important, but I would say that they're relatively less important, and the procedures for this kind of coordination are well-established and straightforward. State Department, USAID have the lead, and they will request DOD support as a last resort, and then DOD will respond to that request. That's the first type of civil-military coordination. And most of our attention, all of our doctrine with humanitarian assistance gets devoted to this. The second format of civil-military coordination, I argue, is much more important, and there's no procedures for it that are in doctrine. And that is in conflict settings where military organizations like ourselves pursuing military objectives, relief organizations arrive to pursue their own objectives, and we have to coexist in the same spaces and somehow not interfere with each other's agendas.
Would you say then that these are the two most important things overall, trying to understand humanitarian affairs, the civil-military coordination, the two aspects of that, and then just understanding the huge scope of the network of global organizations that are working on this?
Yeah, I would say those are two things that all of us as DOD practitioners could take away.
You mentioned Russia and China. And I'm sure that many of our listeners would be curious to know, as you're looking at future warfare, and especially potentially with these significant great power competitors, what are the specific humanitarian issues that you see exacerbated by potential large-scale conflict in each of these regions? And are there problems that are unique to those regions?
Yeah, good question. Just to kind of repeat one of the points that I've already made is that as we prepare for those scenarios, as we plan for them, it's even more important for us to think about and mitigate the humanitarian impact that conflict on that scale would generate. There's going to be a need in that type of interstate war for us to adapt the operational approach and the options that we provide to our own decision makers, even if that adaptation of the operational approach is inconvenient from a military perspective, in order to address and mitigate the impact of a conflict on civilians, as well as allow for access by this multinational, very capable network that we've created, that's independent, international, non-governmental organizations to do their own response, because they have their own mandate and they have their own capabilities that we as military professionals cannot do. They can. They can access areas of need that we cannot. Therefore, whatever operational approach and the options that we provide to our decision makers, they should be very sensitive to these issues. And in doing so, then the legitimacy of our campaign will be enhanced. And even if there's a blow to the tactical, operational, military effectiveness, we will be able to get closer to those sustainable strategic outcomes that we all desire.
Sure, absolutely. And as you're talking about that, the ability of the organizations to do what the military can't do, I'm reminded of one of the things you mentioned in your work, and you talk about these four principles that all aid organizations operate under, and that's recognized by the United Nations and by international law. I remember, I think you talked about humanity, impartiality, neutrality, and independence. And it's because of those four principles that you enumerated that these organizations are able to do what the military can't, and sort of stay out of the political and conflict arena and just focus on the humanitarian needs. As I'm thinking about Russia and China, I'm also reminded, you gave an example of what happened in Somalia in the 1990s. And as you're talking and thinking about civil-military coordination, and trying to strike that tricky balance of offering effective humanitarian aid and at the same time not getting embroiled in these long-term situations that can lead to political or military commitment. What happened in Somalia was it didn't turn out so well. And I'm wondering if you could share some of the details of that scenario with our listeners.
Without getting into the specific case study of Somalia, as we think about what we're going to do when a humanitarian crisis arises, whether that's a mass migration, we saw that in the Middle East and into Europe a few years ago, and how that generated tremendous challenges for our own allies and partners, or another type of humanitarian crisis, whether it's a ethnic cleansing type situation. The instinct often is from across our national security community to deploy uniformed military units, not only to address the situation, but also in the short term to provide some kind of a political image benefit. My takeaway after being deeply involved in this for a few years was that there's another way that has a longer term strategic value. Maybe you don't get that political benefit up front of seeing U.S. military, but that way is to support these multilateral organizations that we've created, and we do support them. We fund them. They wouldn't be able to do what they do, but we can ramp up the support to them, and we can make that role of our foreign policy, our national security enterprise, make that as prominent as we do when we talk about deploying military. I think that's more strategically effective, and over the longer term is going to provide that political benefit even greater, and mitigates the risk of getting embroiled into a situation such as what you had mentioned in Somalia in the early 90s.
I'm wondering now, getting into the weeds a little bit here, are there particular circumstances and situations where you think that humanitarian and military efforts are more likely to get their wires crossed? And if there are particular circumstances where that happens, what, with all of your on-the-ground experience and your knowledge of these matters, what are certain practices that you would recommend for achieving the more positive outcomes in these difficult situations?
I've got kind of a two-part answer. First of all, the situation where we have the wires crossed, the greatest is if we had a natural disaster, a hurricane like we've seen over the last couple of weeks, where there's an instinctive deployment of military forces without any coordination with these international and non-governmental organizations. What we want to do is we want to follow the lead of the State Department and USAID, and to avoid doing that until there's an identified need that's the last resort. But as I said, I think we all kind of have this concept nailed, and it's getting a lot of attention. So the second part of the answer is, if we can find a way to coordinate our collective responses, whether it's military or whether it's these humanitarian organizations, then we can achieve some strategic synergy. We're never going to be on the same team. We're never going to be under the same command structure, but we do have a lot of commonalities in terms of our strategic goals. So one example of that is the ability that the humanitarians bring to bear to support and stabilize governments that are under tremendous pressure because of mass migration, because of large populations of refugees that completely overwhelm those governments' ability to provide any basic protection. Well, the humanitarian relief organizations are able to go and respond to that and to prevent it from getting worse, and then turn the corner and allow capacity building to occur. They can do that by an order of magnitude better than we could by trying to send in, for example, a task force of U.S. Army or Special Forces. That's what I would say is, you know, if we get the wires crossed, let's try to get them crossed in a good way rather than these counterproductive approaches of getting into each other's ways.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thinking over everything you just said and sort of trying to synthesize and pull all of this together, thinking about best practices for the future, like you're saying, the two biggest things that need to happen are letting state and USAID take the lead, disaster situations and other situations where they are better equipped to handle whatever's happening. And then the second big thing is to remember that the NGOs, together with state, and perhaps also the military, that we all have these same strategic goals in mind. So maybe we should try to remember that more frequently, act like that more frequently, and really coordinate our responses to work together. And like you said, crossing our wires in the right way. I like that. I like that phrase. And I'm just wondering, looking ahead, not just to the difficult situations, but also just more generally, could you highlight some of the ways that the defense community should consider its relationship with the organizations that provide humanitarian aid? Is there any other way that it would be helpful for them to think about that relationship beyond these two big principles?
I think that we need to recognize that there's a pretty big bias in the way that we are thinking about this. And this is reflected most dramatically in our joint doctrine on humanitarian assistance. And that's that we're not just talking about DOD support to humanitarian assistance in with unique capabilities. That's important, and that's why we have the doctrine. But there's a much bigger issue that is not addressed, and we need to recognize this, and that is, what is the role that we have when we're applying military force, when we're deploying into a area of need for military action, and the humanitarian relief organizations are doing the same thing. This is the much more interesting topic. This is the much more interesting challenge and the more rewarding area. Those international organizations and NGOs, they recognize this as well, and they are very, very capable of having this sophisticated conversation. There's an unfortunate stereotype, and maybe I had this sometime in the past, that these are sort of casual, flip-flop wearing type people that are disorganized in some sense. And that's one thing that I can confirm, is that that is wrong. These are very competent, professional, dedicated individuals that know what they're doing. I would argue they share a lot of the same values that we as military professionals, as foreign service officers have, in terms of dedication and self-service and willingness to go accomplish a mission if asked to do it. I think that together, this is a sophisticated conversation that we can gain a lot out of.
Absolutely. And I really like the emphasis you place on recognizing that in the two professions, there is that same sense of selflessness and dedication and just giving yourself over wholly to a cause that you believe in and are willing to lay everything down for it. I think that's a great way to get the two sides maybe to coordinate better, is to focus on that similarity in dedication and in purpose. Well, I think we are just about done here, but I did want to ask you, and this is an easy question, I think, but just to maybe emphasize it for our listeners, is there a better time or a worse time for military leaders when you're looking at future warfare, future conflict? When in that grand arc of any conflict do these military leaders need to focus on humanitarian aid and humanitarian needs?
I think what my recommendation, what my argument is, that we need to think about it now. Even if we were to look at humanitarian trends, OCHA does this in other organizations, to see what the level of forcible displacement of people are in every one of those trend lines. You know, even with disasters, I'm not an expert on disaster, but I've seen a lot of them, and you could argue that they could be tied to climate change. But this is not going away, so we need to think about it now. I'm not the first person to make this argument. I know that particularly at U.S. Africa Command, they have been leaning forward on this more than anyone else. I had the opportunity to be a part of that, and that's from the four-star level down to the country teams across the continent. Also with U.S. Indo-PACOM, their Center for Excellence for Disaster Management and Humanitarian Assistance. So I'm not the first one to make this argument. what I want to see, what I think that would be a good thing for our collective readiness and preparedness is to have that kind of energy displayed across the joint force. And I think that that is something that would be worthwhile.
Well, sir, thank you so much for giving us all of that information and for sharing all of your expertise with us, and especially for the recommendations about the best way to move forward. Obviously, this is no easy task at hand, but certainly with good advice and good practices, we can make much better work of it than otherwise. And that's thanks to your own efforts and sharing your thought. And I just really appreciate that. So thank you for all that you do for our Army and our nation, and of course, for the work that you do on behalf of people from nations all over the world. And listeners, if you'd like to read some of Lieutenant Colonel Cahill's work on this topic, AUSA had the privilege of publishing one of his studies earlier this year, Humanitarian Assistance in Future Warfare, and that's available on our website at ausa.org/education. Lieutenant Colonel Cahill, thank you.
To all our listeners, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere podcasts are found. The Army Matters podcast series is brought to you by the Association of the United States Army, the U.S. Army's professional association, member-supported, Army-connected. Visit us at AUSA.org for more information or to become a member. Your membership helps AUSA continue to carry out its mission to educate, inform, and connect with the total Army, our industry partners, and our supporters of a strong national defense. For questions or to provide topic recommendations, email us at podcast@ausa.org. Have a great Army Day. Hooah.